Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
Let's put aside whether or not Andrew was involved in the wrongdoing. Surely the right thing to do is to share what he knows about what were crime scenes.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find it on the ABC Listen app.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap.
This has been 6 years of a roller coaster ride. Yeah, frankly, if you've been on a roller coaster for that long, you want to get to the end, frankly, at the end. And I was most relieved. In fact, I choked up a bit when the legislation was passed last night by the Senate.
That is the man who wrote the blueprint for the long-awaited environmental law reforms, secured by the government yesterday with the help of the Greens. You'll get his reaction, and that from the government and the Greens.
Susan Lee has got to just accept the fact that her own side of politics was completely incapable of reaching a deal with us.
These were tough negotiations, I'd have to say, the toughest political negotiation I've done in my career.
So how did the deal get done in the final sitting week of the year? We'll cover the detail in just a moment. Then, for the third consecutive season, the same two teams will face off in the AFLW Grand Final. A remarkable feat for the Kangaroos and the Lions. That chat is coming up later on. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. It's good to have you with us for the last episode of The Breakfast Wrap for the week. Well, yesterday we brought you that breaking news that the federal government had secured a deal with the Greens to pass its long-awaited overhaul of the federal environment laws. Then it was able to pass the Senate before going to the House of Reps today. Ahead of the vote, we interviewed a pretty chuffed environment minister and the Greens environment spokesperson. But before we get to those interviews, someone else who is breathing a sigh of relief. The former competition watchdog, Professor Graeme Samuel, wrote the blueprint for the revamp of the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act. He did that with an independent review 5 years ago. He came on with Sally to discuss this deal being secured by the government.
Professor Samuel, how does the revised legislation that's passed the Senate, how does it compare to the recommendations that you made in your review 5 years ago?
I think the legislation faithfully reflects the totality of the review. There's, in substance, I don't think there's been any variation at all. So I'm very pleased with what's happened. The outcome of the deal done with the Greens has been to strengthen some of the environmental protections, but importantly, and this very important, it hasn't reduced or diminished in any way the business efficiency elements of the review and of the legislation as initially put to Parliament a couple of weeks ago. So what we've achieved, I think, is a terrific balance between business efficiency and environmental efficacy or effectiveness.
The Coalition says that it wanted to keep negotiating with the government into next year. In your view, was this process rushed, or was it the best deal the government was going to get in this timeframe?
I think Minister Watt and the Prime Minister have demonstrated remarkable ability to achieve an outcome within the time frame that they set. Look, we've got to remember that this has been going for 5 years, as far as I'm concerned, for 6 years, because I started the review in October 2019. So this has been 6 years of a roller coaster ride. Frankly, if you've been on a roller coaster for that long, you want to get to the end, frankly, at the end. And I was most relieved. In fact, I choked up a bit when the legislation was passed last night by the Senate. The Coalition, I think, unfortunately, over a period of 5 years, has gone through a process of obfuscation, contradictions, obstruction. They actually manoeuvred themselves, I think, in the past week to a position of complete irrelevance. And the Greens put forward a package of amendments which were sensible. In particular, I was pleased with what was done with the regional forest agreements because, they were a real concern, as expressed in the review. But importantly, and this is is terribly important. The government has done something that we've urged governments to do for year after year after year, and that is to have some form of structural adjustment assistance to assist those who are adversely impacted by reform. In this case, what the government has done in terms of the forestry industry is to allocate a fund of $300 million towards structural adjustment assistance. Now, we'll have to see some detail as to how that's done, but I think that was an inspired process and inspired introduction into the process at the last minute. And what it's done is to say to those that will be adversely impacted, we are here to help you through the process. We'll do it with a fund of $300 million. And at the same time, we've achieved greater protection for our native forests, which were suffering so badly through the deforestation or logging process.
You were talking about some of the way in which the Coalition has approached this matter. What do you think about, what are your thoughts more broadly about the way the Coalition has handled this, not only in opposition, but in government in the early stages as well?
Look, I have to say, and I've said this openly, I've been very disappointed. The review was handed to then Minister, Environment Minister Lee in October 2020, was publicly released in January 21. Minister Lee embraced the review. She embraced it with some enthusiasm and said, look, this is what I've been expecting and I welcome it. And then for some reason, and I think I know what happened in the government at the time, she was put into a straitjacket as to what she could do in terms of response to the review, and thus we saw nothing of any substance. We moved then into the election of the Albanese government, and Tanya Plibersek, with an enormous degree of commitment, tried so hard to bring about the implementation of the review, but that failed. It just didn't work. And now we've had Minister Murray Watt, who's proceeded, I think, with remarkable agility to bring about the reforms that we saw approved by the Senate. I was sitting in the Senate and, look, it was just extraordinary. The questions being asked were very appropriate. The answers he gave showed a remarkable knowledge of the legislation and what it proposes to do. The Greens came to the party, and I've got a lot of admiration, I have to say, for Senator Sarah Hanson-Young. She was under a lot of pressure from a whole range of different sources, but she agreed on a series of amendments, and I saw the amendments, I saw the summation of them, and frankly went down in a matter of 5 minutes, put tick, 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 double tick on a few of them, and tick all the way through. They are sensible amendments, and they will work better to protect our environment and to help its restoration.
She says there's still a lot more to do. What's your response to that view?
It's a view that I know the Greens have, and there are various sort of ranges of expression of that view. But the climate issues are dealt with in a separate area of the department. It's the area that is governed by Minister Bowen, and that's the way it should work. There is a lot more work to be done, though, in relation to the environment protection legislation, and that relates to the development of the National Environmental Standards. Now, these standards are fundamental. They're the rules that will govern the way the Commonwealth administers the law, the way states and territories administer it, the way states and territories will be accredited in under a single-touch process that gives greater efficiency and to business in terms of applications for developments, so that states and territories that are accredited will be able to do all the assessment and all the approvals subject to, and this is so important, subject to their abiding by and complying with the National Environmental Standards. Now, those standards have to be developed in the new year, in 2026. A lot of work to be done there.
And that is the former competition watchdog, Professor Graeme Samuel, on Radio National Breakfast with Sally Sarah. And he was comparing the government's environmental law reforms to the recommendations that he handed down 5 years ago. He says it faithfully reflects the totality of his review. Well, let's turn to the politics of it all with the Minister for the Environment and Water, Murray Watt.
You made it quite clear, Minister, that you wanted this legislation to pass the Parliament this year. Do you believe that the urgency has delivered the best outcome?
Yes, I do, Sally. As I've said many times, there's simply no more time to wait to get these reforms passed. It's now more than 5 years since Graham Samuel produced his review and recommendations for overhauling these laws. And remember, he said in his report that the current law was fundamentally broken, that it was failing the environment, failing business, failing the community, and we had to get moving. You can't keep waiting and putting off something in search of perfection. And what you will have seen yesterday is that a very wide range of stakeholders in the business community, in the environment sector, have acknowledged that this is a good step forward. So I think it would have been a mistake to keep kicking the can down the road on these reforms. And I'm very pleased that we've been able to pass it through the Senate, and obviously we'll be able to pass it through the House of Representatives today, and it will be the law.
But not all business groups in industry are happy, to be fair. What immediate impact will this have on the development pipeline? How much faster, for example, will new homes, renewable projects and other important infrastructure be built?
Well, I think, and I accept that not everyone is universally supportive of exactly the model we've put forward. And as I say, I don't think you ever make a big change like this where 100% of people are 100% happy. But what you will have seen yesterday is positive comments from the housing sector, the renewable sector. I heard Innes Willicks from the AI Group on your program earlier, broadly positive about this. The biggest change is that we'll see in terms of the development pipeline and processes is a real streamlining of those processes and removing some of the duplication that currently sits in the system, where proponents of projects have very often got to get a state assessment and approval followed by a federal assessment and approval, which simply drag the process out in some cases for years. What we expect in the short to medium term is a much quicker process for considering what the environmental impacts on of projects and working towards getting them approved where appropriate as quickly as we can.
Minister Brand Black from the Business Council of Australia says while significant changes have been made to the unacceptable impacts provision, that there is concern that there's still ambiguity and risk which may shut out projects before a proper assessment. What do you say to that?
Look, I understand that some of the large business groups might have liked to have seen further changes, but one of the conditions of the agreement we reached with the Greens was not only that we accept amendments that they were seeking, but that they accept amendments that we were seeking.
Minister, the opposition leader, Susan Lee, says that these reforms will, quote, put energy prices up because you gave the Greens what they wanted. Will these reforms put up power prices?
No, they won't. And if anything, they will assist with getting energy projects online more quickly, which will help with the supply of energy. But obviously, if we can have more supply in the system more quickly, then that is going to help moderate prices when it comes to energy. And I'm afraid Susan Lee has got to just accept the fact that her own side of politics was completely incapable of reaching a deal with us. So they've got no one to blame but themselves if they're unhappy about a deal being struck with the Greens.
And you were just listening to the Minister for the Environment and Water, Murray Watt, speaking with Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. So how did the government reach this deal with the Greens? The Greens environment spokesperson, Sarah Hanson-Young, also joined the program.
Look, it is a good day for the environment. And it's a good day for our forests and our Australian bushland. Good day for our wildlife.
Yesterday you said you didn't get everything that you wanted in the negotiations. Was there a particular concession from the government that tipped the scales for you to agree to a deal?
Look, these were tough negotiations. I'd have to say the toughest political negotiation I've done in my career, and we got a good result. But of course, we went into these negotiations saying we wanted to get better protections for our forests and our bushland and wildlife, and we wanted better protections for climate. We got better protections for our forests and bush yesterday and our native wildlife, and that's a really important step forward. It says time's up for destroying our native forests, and the logging industry has to transition. We've got to get them out of the native forests and into where it's much more productive, and that's plantation.
The Environment Minister Murray Watt urged the Greens to learn the lessons of the past and, quote, not block meaningful reform in the search for perfection. Have you been more pragmatic this time?
The Greens' role is to, you know, we will block bad laws if we can't fix them. But here we were able to get a good result, an important result. But we're also, and this is really important, we were also able to stop coal and gas getting fast-tracked. And for the first time in Australia's environment laws, there's now a two-class system. And we have kept fossil fuels in the slow lane. You know, I want them out of the lane. We can't have any more new coal and gas mines if we want to meet our targets and reduce carbon pollution.
Sarah Hanson-Young there, the Greens environment spokesperson, ending this week's coverage of the environmental law reforms on The Breakfast Wrap. Well, turning overseas, and it's been a year since Hezbollah signed a ceasefire deal with Israel. Yet, almost 130 people have died in Lebanon since that agreement. And just this week, Israel killed more civilians in airstrikes in Lebanon's south. It's resulted in the Lebanese Prime Minister criticising Hezbollah for failing to disarm, saying that its refusal to do so is hurting the country. The attacks are fueling fears of another war, a wider war. Hezbollah's warned that the recent strikes have crossed a red line, while there are still thousands of displaced civilians yet to return to their homes. Anshal Vora is an international affairs columnist at Foreign Policy magazine. She outlined just what all sides are saying.
So the Israelis say that according to them, Hezbollah started to rebuild. They've claimed that they've decimated the group, but now the group is starting to, you know, bring back its cadre and start the work of rebuilding its organization militarily as well. And they see it fit to go ahead and keep attacking Lebanon, which is extremely problematic for the Lebanese government, which for once actually has international credibility and domestic credibility, both the prime minister and the president. And they find it very difficult to convince, to sort of gather domestic support if they have to disarm Hezbollah if Israel keeps attacking, because this is Hezbollah's reason to have arms in the first place, threat from Israel.
So the Lebanese Prime Minister Nawaf Salam has come out criticising Hezbollah overnight. How unusual or significant is that?
Extremely unusual, very significant, and in fact, very brave of him. Lebanon, Hezbollah is the only entity that is armed, and there's always a fear. Essentially, Hezbollah can do what it wants, even after it's been attacked and decimated to, not decimated, I'd say, but, you know, they've taken quite a beating in the war with Israel last year. But despite that, they continue to have arms. They've got strong support. Hezbollah is not just a number of armed fighters, but a large number of people in Shia community back the group. And for the Prime Minister to come out and actually call out Hezbollah is quite a brave move.
How would you describe the popularity of Hezbollah in Lebanon right now?
Oh, the Shia community, it still has backers. And in some ways, there are others in Lebanon also who sympathize with the group more now because of its recent war with Israel. And, you know, in a ways, the conflict has proved Hezbollah's point, right, that it is essentially trying to protect the Lebanese from Israel. However, having said that, I've lived in Lebanon for many, many years, and I've spoken to people in many communities there. And there was sort of a sense of people being kind of desperate to, have a country with a normal country where a group that calls itself a political group does not have arms and essentially doesn't call the shots, doesn't rule over the government. So there's also a lot of disenchantment with the group.
What do we know about Hezbollah's capability to fight back at the moment?
And not much. They do not have the capabilities right now, in a way, you know, but they still have the pride. We've got to kind of understand how this group operates. If you are in Lebanon, if you're in any of these areas which have Hezbollah supporters, you cannot get out of your car, you cannot take out your phone if you are a foreigner and even take a photograph. Anybody can just come to you and ask you to not do that, and anybody could be a spy, a sympathizer, or a supporter. These groups, as I earlier said, you know, this is not a militia. They have huge support in their communities. So what they still have is a community, or many people in that community, I don't know how many, but many who back the group, who see a reason for it to exist.
Anshal Vora is an international affairs columnist at Foreign Policy magazine, discussing that situation in Lebanon.
The premiership fight will be between the Kangaroos and the Lions.
And that has become a pretty familiar sound at the business end of the AFLW competition in recent years. For the third consecutive season, North Melbourne and Brisbane will face off in the AFLW Grand Final. It's also the Lions' seventh decider in the league's first 10 seasons. A fourth flag would really cement their powerhouse status, but to get it, they'll need to go through the Roos, who haven't lost a game in 2 years. It's looking to be an incredible matchup. So to preview what will be an awesome game of footy, we invited on the Lions' head of women's football, Brianna Block, who tried to explain just how the team has been so successful.
A lot of blood, sweat and tears, really. I mean, it's a credit to the playing group who continue to, you know, strive to get better every single year, but also the staff that we have, you know, in support of them, who come up with all wild and crazy ways to keep pushing the group, keep them engaged and, yeah, keep them hungry.
And what about the pipeline? How much focus is there on spotting and developing the talent that might pay off for you in the years ahead? Because this has been a very consistent run from the Brisbane Lions.
Yeah, look, we're pretty fortunate up here in Queensland. My previous role to coming over to the Lions was developing women and girls opportunities through pathways and talent programs. So we pushed pretty hard in the early days, way before AFLW was even a glint in someone's eye. So we've got really good club programs and talent programs for girls up there, and we've been consistently performing at a high level in women's football for a very long time. So we've been blessed just to have, I suppose, started early, and we're reaping the rewards.
But what does the research and your own anecdotal experience tell you about why girls and young women are coming to play footy?
Look, I was 25 when I first started playing football, so came very, very late. And from what, you know, football's a game for everyone. You can be any shape, size, fast, slow. So unlike other sports where, you know, you need to be tall really to be successful at basketball, even netball now you need to be pretty tall. But it's also got this great element of physicality that many girls don't get as they're growing up in girls' sports. So the contest, the tackling, getting down in the mud and getting dirty, being loud and vocal and not aggressive, but, you know, strong and powerful, I think, is really what it is. And that's celebrated and not, you know, poo-pooed. You know, you often hear in netball, you know, God, she's so rough and aggressive and people don't like those girls. But in footy, that's the type of stuff you want to see. So I feel like girls get really empowered, feel strong physically, and then that, you know, we hope turns into really great self-confidence as well. And you've got these really confident, strong women out there playing footy and having a great time.
What about getting mum and dad on board? Sometimes there can be some concerns about the physicality of the game, but also it's really interesting sometimes you dig up the stories, particularly of the mums who wish that they'd had that kind of opportunity when they were a similar age.
So I think, look, we're lucky probably in Queensland that, you know, we're sort of at three contact sports, you know, rugby league, rugby union, AFL, that we're probably seen as the lesser aggressive of the
football
three.
Light.
Yeah, football light, you know, so it's probably a little bit more palatable. But we also have a large group, you know, mums and dads who, you know, don't know anything about AFL, and their kids are the ones who are introducing them to the sport. So we've seen heaps of mums and join footy. But I think when they see their girls play and how much fun and joy they have, well, I think that kind of fear dissipates. It's been an incredible journey to watch. And that connection also between dads and daughters, that's one of the things I've really cherished over the last 20 years.
Erin Phillips and her dad kind of personifies that, doesn't it?
Mm. So much. Mm. And we're getting all these people involved in community football clubs that now look like society, that they're half female, you know, lots of women around, women in positions of presidency or vice president and running clubs, where that didn't, you know, probably exist 25 years ago. It was, you know, purely a male dominated environment. So it was pretty, you know, daunting at times in the early days of getting girls teams in places and things like that. And it's just so normalized now. So it's great.
And that is the Lions head of women's football, Brianna Block, there on Radio National Breakfast with Sally Sarah. Well, thank you so much for listening to the Breakfast Wrap across the week. Every interview you've heard was presented by Sally Sarah, produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, and the Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Josie Asher. Our executive producer is Eleni Saltis, and I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We'll see you next week, same time, same place.